Now, Dork Uncorked with Rod Phillips and Ryan Price on CFAX 1070.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the program. Welcome to Dork Uncorked with me, Ryan, your co-pilot on Dork Uncorked. But now, let's introduce the main dork, the king dork on this program. In this context, Rod Phillips. Now, and also in this context, wine dork. You know, there's all kinds of dorks in the world. You are the wine dork of this program. And hello, yeah. Rod Phillips.
Yeah, hello. Wonderful introduction. My parents would be so proud.
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, like the wine, you're the wine dork. It's better than being a dork about other things. You're not a Star Wars dork, or maybe you are. I don't know. You're not a, you know, you're not a book dork. You are a wine dork.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And, you know, there's not too often that, I have been to get-togethers whereby there's been other dorks that have certainly found comrades to chat about. But often when, you know, somebody finds out that you're a wine dork, oh, well, then the conversation continues.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. The wine dork of this program, Rod Phillips, and I try to catch up. That's kind of what the show is. That's a much tighter description of what the show is all about right there. And on today's episode of Dork Uncorked, here's what you're in for. Back in February, we played another round of a game we've been doing for a while here called And Now Pair This, where in some way I make Rod, without knowing what he's going to be asked, pair a wine to a food or a food to a wine. We've been doing that for a while. We've done all kinds of variations. Sometimes we've worked AI into it, and you've used ChatGPT to compete against you, and we'll have to do another one of those sometime soon. But back in February, the last time we played this, we did this particular version that I found so selfishly useful because it helped me with my week's meal planning, because I do the shopping and the cooking at home. I had you pair a multi-course meal to a wine. And I love this concept because we've often talked about that as sometimes tricky because, you know, a wine might go really well with one dish you're having, but then you have a salad with it and it throws the whole thing off or something. So it can be sometimes difficult to get a wine that'll work throughout a whole meal. And that's probably why, like, often you'll go to a fancy restaurant and you'll get wine pairings with your meals, and they bring you a different wine for every course you have, because, you know, a different wine is going to pair with so many, like, with different things. You kind of need that that variety. But every once in a while, you're not wanting to have a fancy meal that's going to have, like, eight different wines for all of your courses. You're just, it's just Saturday. It's just you and your wife, and you want a wine. You just want one wine that's going to work with two or three different things you're going to be having. You know, two to three courses maybe you're making for a nice Sunday dinner. You've got a salad, or you've got a starter, or some sort of appetizer, followed by some sort of main, or maybe it's just a main and a dessert. Who knows? There might be a couple of things, but that could be, it could be hard to find a wine that'll go with both of those things, or it can be hard to find, you know, courses that will go with the one wine. This can be a trick. So this is how we have made Rod's life very difficult by
enriched. I would use the term enriched.
by turning this game into here's a wine, Rod. Now plan a several course meal around this wine without having any idea what I'm going to tell you. I love it because the last time we did this, you gave me so many great ideas. I made this this Dijon and rosemary encrusted pork tenderloin roasted with parsnips and carrots, served with a salad that was dressed in nothing but sesame oil and black pepper, which was delicious. So those were the two courses for that one, and I was so happy that you went and planned that meal for me. So happy that I'm doing it to you again.
Well, there you go. That's the that is the best. What do they call it? That is the best gratuity one can get is to say, yeah, can we do that again?
Yeah, that was so good. We're doing it again. So that's the main thing we're going to get to shortly on this episode of Dork Uncorked, another round of And Now Pair This, the meal planning edition. I'm so excited, and I'm putting together my list of what wines I'm going to throw at you, and I've got some fun stuff, I think, today. So we're going to do that coming up. But first, As always, we like to just sort of catch up on what's going on in the wine world a little bit. Sometimes we like to start the show with a bit of booze in the news. And Rod, I think there's something on your mind today.
Yeah. There's an article that caught my attention as I was scanning through the internet. A statement that made me stop, and it said 90% of the world's wine regions may not exist by the end of the century. Yeah, so in other words, 76 years from now. And it made me stop because, you know, we've talked often and we've talked to people about climate change and how it's impacting things. You know, you don't have to look too far or for news stories, you know, that where climate change is impacting wine production. Look at the Okanagan, you know, what they've gone through this winter and last summer with the wildfires and things like that. But this article really caught my attention because 90%, that's an awful lot of wine. That's an awful lot of wine. So I went back to it and I looked at it and thought, is this just one of those clickbait type of organizations, or is this legitimate? And yeah, I'm going to leave it for you to decide, but it was CBS News. So I'm thinking that's relatively legitimate. You know, amongst all the people who come up with these things, but their conjecture was that 90% by 2100, 90% of the world's wine regions would cease to exist. And the when you look at the map, where they and how they identified the ones that are most at risk, are if I were to ask you to name off the top five wine regions in the world that come to mind immediately. No thinking about it. What would they be?
Okay, so Spain. Yeah. I know they produce a just ton of wine. I think France, obviously, France is the wine region, right? As is Italy.
Yeah.
So I've got, can those be separate wine regions or is that just Europe?
No, those are definitely separate
okay.
wine regions.
So I got Spain.
They've got their own bureaucrats.
I got you know, Spain and my own bureaucrats. Spain and France and Italy, they come right to mind. California, obviously, one of the world's big wine regions. I'm thinking Australia, New Zealand, that part of the world. You know, those are the ones that leap to mind. And I guess, you know, the emerging new world wine regions also of Chile and Argentina, like that. I guess those come to mind as well. Chile is a huge player nowadays in the wine world. So those are the ones I'm thinking of.
Yeah, each of those are in the very high risk category.
Really?
Namely, Spain, France, Italy, California are in the highest risk areas to be affected. Yeah. So you've been down to Disneyland in Southern California before.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
There's a region just south of Palm Springs actually called Temecula.
Okay.
And Temecula, not a big region. Obviously, you know, fairly dry, you know, very warm. And about 10 to 15 years ago, there was a lot of investment, maybe going back 20 years ago, because it was, you know, the cost of land in Sonoma and Napa Valley was just skyrocketing. It was, you know, unaffordable for anybody with a passion for making wine. But Temecula, you know, had some really attractive elements to it, the soil type, you know, the temperature days, all those kind of things. So there's a lot of investment in that area. And the problem has become that they expect that Temecula as a wine region to not exist in maybe 10 to 15 years. It's just, you know, the climate is not conducive to wine growing. So some of the, in this article, you're by all means, you know, go ahead and read the article, but you know, they talk about the temperature, they talk about drought conditions, you know, the intensity of weather patterns, all of these things that we know about and we've talked about many times before. In fact, I wonder if we are now at a point whereby we need a clickbait type headline, like 90% of the world's wine regions will no longer exist, will cease to exist. Yeah, that's a pretty shocking headline. It's a pretty shocking statement. Of course, it's going to grab some attention. But maybe that's we've become so complacent, it seems. That we've become so complacent that, you know, we haven't really done much to change the way that we approach things. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of pain, but just think of that. You know, think of the kind of pain that the world's world will be in a scenario whereby wine regions don't exist anymore. Like, I can't imagine what our great great grandkids will have to be living with.
Does this article drill into some of the specifics? Because I'm gathering the two things that'll happen. One of the big things for these wine regions is drought. Is mm-hmm. it, once like I'm thinking California specifically, which is starting to really show signs of drought problems already. And this is now like and as climate change accelerates, could that be what they're talking about? Is it also that it's just going to get too hot?
Both of those two things are the main contributors. The other thing is the extremes, right? So, you know, extreme heat being one of the ones you just mentioned, but the other part of the extremes is you get a lot of water in a short period of time, right? If you're getting a ton of rain, like, back in early February, we went down to visit a family in Palm Springs, and it was, we happened to time it just perfectly where we got off the plane and the atmospheric river started. And when we got back on the plane, or just before we got back on the plane, is when it ended. But it was a torrential downpour. Like, I've never seen it rain that hard in my lifetime. Even when I lived in the Caribbean, it never rained that hard. It was a ton of water in a very short period of time. So what that ends up doing is you know, there's really nowhere for that amount of water to go in a short period of time. So you get flooding, you get all these, and that flooding leads to soil erosion, which means now you've got, less arable land to work with. So those extremes, the temperature, the extreme weather events, and just general drought. Like, if you've got that kind of thing happening, and you got extended drought, then there's going to be less water available, period. Groundwater or, river or mountain roll-off water, you're just going to be less of it. We're getting less snow. This year, I don't know if you tried to go up to Mount Washington this year, but, man, there was only a couple days, from what I had heard, that they actually had enough snow to have that. So, and that snow melts, and that becomes the fresh water that we find in our rivers in spring. And if there isn't much there, then there's not much water being put back into the system. That makes all that sense. I don't know. But I think you know where I'm going with it.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And this makes me think of is as those big wine regions that you mentioned, some news coverage this week just sort of pointing out that modeling is suggesting with climate change, some of those major wine regions like California won't be able to support wine growing come 100 years from now. Is that one of the reasons why we are starting to see business kind of hedging their bets and preparing for that by the big business behind wineries buying wineries further north in places like Vancouver Island as a way to maybe start investing in what could become future wine regions when those wine regions disappear. I'm thinking of just a few years ago, what was it, 2020, that Unsworth up in the Cowichan Valley mm-hmm. was purchased by, it's Jackson Brands, is that the one?
Jackson Family Wine Estates.
Right.
And they recently purchased Blue Gross as well.
Yeah, so they're, and that's a big American wine conglomerate, right?
Yep, Kendall Jackson is the main name.
Yeah, and they're and here they are starting to purchase up Vancouver Island wineries. And do you think that there's anything there? Like, is that partially what they're doing?
Well, it probably is, but the challenge will be that California is irreplaceable in many ways, because you've got unlike here and in the Okanagan, one of the challenges that we have here is that we have relatively small plots of land. Whereas the wine growing regions, certainly in France, Italy, Spain, and California, a typical vineyard is a lot larger, and therefore it is doing a lot more production. Whereas when you get into what we'll refer to as marginal areas, here on the island, you're talking about smaller areas that would be plantable. So you're never going to be able to replace a California or a France just by moving north. Right. So that's one of the challenges. But definitely, I'm sure that there's a lot of people that are hedging their bets. I mean, one of the things that has been happening for years is a lot of investments in New World regions by Old World producers. So the cost of, if you wanted to get 1 acre of planted vineyard in Bordeaux, it would be, it's in the, you know, tens of millions of dollars. Whereas you can get 100 plantable acres or planted acres, say in Chile, for half of that. Still expensive, but half of that. Same thing within the Okanagan, half of that. So from an investment point of view, if you've got that extra money kicking around like the Rothschilds do, even the Torres family in Spain does, you know, they are looking at these areas. To us, it's super expensive, but to them, it's relatively inexpensive, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. No. All right. Well, maybe we should leave that there, Rod. Anything else to say on that story?
I hope not.
Ah, okay. Well, let's you know what? That's enough doom and gloom. I think we should yeah. pivot now to the fun. We'll take our first break here. When we get back, and now pair this, the meal planning edition. Are you ready?
I am set.
Okay, stand by. Coming up in just a moment. One. All right, now.
And now, pair this.
Yes, it's the game where I give Rod, not literally, but I prompt Rod with a wine, and he has to, off the top of his head, pair it with food. At least that's the direction we're going to go for today in this round, but with the twist that it's not just one food item or meal he has to pair this wine with. He needs to do at least two, because this is a whole like multi-course meal prep that he needs to come up with. The point being, it can be very difficult to have several courses in a meal that will go with the same wine. So if you just want to have one wine that's going to go with everything, he's gonna work it all out for you and come up with the whole plan off the top of his head.
Yeah. It's interesting that the timing of this is the same timing as the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Exactly.
I think there's some symmetry there. Yeah.
I think you're right. This is like we should do a parallel Stanley Cup of wine pairing. But we'll need to get some opposing players. We'll need to invite some other wine people from the community in to take part and see who gets the cup in the end. And the cup is basically just literally a cup of wine in this case. But
exactly.
Okay. But hey, let's get to it. So we've already explained the premise of what you're doing. Now we're going to do some reds. We're going to do some whites, I think, is the goal. But I actually want to start with the reds. We always start white and work red, but I'm gonna reverse it. And here's the other thing that we don't often do, but I really want to do to make this one special, is often I don't pick BC wines for these for whatever reason. So the first two reds are going to be BC reds. That's the gimmick here.
All right.
Which may break our usual Dork Uncorked price range, but you know what? Hey, we're having fun.
Yeah, there you go.
The first thing you do, and I'm not going to be too specific, it's more regional and not an exact brand, but I would like you to come up with at least two courses of a meal that goes with a Pinot Noir grown on Vancouver Island.
Okay, Vancouver Island Pinot Noir. I am going to, yeah, I should probably just go straight to the cheese plate.
No. Okay, yeah.
just go straight to the cheese plate. So here's where I'm going to go. There's a couple options here. One of which is going to be like a goat cheese salad. But the salad is going to be arugula with goat cheese and like a simple dressing, like just olive oil or whatever, but with some sesame seeds sunflower seeds in it.
Okay.
So that's number one. Number two, you can't really be Vancouver Island Pinot Noir without Vancouver Island wild caught salmon.
Yes, of course.
So yeah, cedar plank salmon, grilled salmon, baked salmon, doesn't really matter. That's where I would go. Would be a salmon dish to go with that.
Now, are you keeping
really
the salmon
too far wrong?
Other than something like a cedar plank, are you keeping the salmon pretty much just like fairly plain, maybe a little salt and pepper, but like really just letting the salmon stand alone? Is that the idea here?
Yeah. So like, I don't eat a lot of salmon, but when I do, I want to taste the salmon
It's
kind of like. There's an old tradition, like, I don't know if you spent much time in the Caribbean, but there's a lot of these, what they call jerk houses. And they're like literally tin shacks that they make jerk is a seasoning or like a spice that they apply to it. And, you know, some of the meats that they use are things like goat. And, you know, they used to say that one of the reasons why the jerk seasoning is so strong is the goat itself. And same, they'll use sheep, so in other words, mutton, because that is so strong, they got to come up with something. Whereas the, you know, things like our West Coast salmon here, the flavor profile has a lot of delicacy, but it has a lot of power to it. You don't want to cover it up with a, you know, really strong seasoning, I don't think.
Yeah. Like some parts of the world have come up with very strong spices and flavorings because they're covering up stuff that otherwise doesn't taste as good by itself. Like that's one of the reasons that's evolved.
Makes it palatable, right?
You're either trying to make something boring exciting or something that's offensive palatable. You know, one of those two things is happening. But we don't have that. Salmon is delicious by itself. In fact, that's why, you know, I think it's so popular to have it done as more of a sashimi kind of Japanese style, where you're not having anything other than just, you're not even cooking it. It's just like, here is the thing by itself, uncooked, unflavored. It's just delicious by itself. The texture, the flavors, everything. So yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
Well, just to recap, because I love this already. You've got a goat cheese salad, and by that you mean there's something like arugula with the goat cheese and a very simple dressing like a vinaigrette, olive oil, and some sunflower seeds. And then
And I would stay away from vinaigrette.
Oh, okay.
I find often vinegar just doesn't do it for me. I know lots of people love it. That's why it's on, you go to a restaurant and they give you a salad and there's a vinaigrette on it. See, I find it too acidic.
This is just an oil, olive oil, and
just
the sunflower seeds. Okay, and then you're having it with a very simple salmon. Maybe it's done on a cedar plank. Maybe it's just been baked or barbecued. Simply a little salt and pepper. Nothing too crazy.
Yeah.
Are you putting something with that? Is there a potato beside that, or rice, or what? What are you? Is there a starch you're serving with that salmon?
Well, often I like to make like a fresh pasta with a little bit of pesto. That would be an adornment that I like. Two weeks ago, I tried my hand at making Greek potatoes. And one of
Greek potatoes.
Yeah. One of the ways that this would pair well is that you're probably going to have some lemon somewhere in with the salmon, right? So, and lemon is a key ingredient along with oregano and olive oil and a little bit of chicken stock or something like that in making the Greek potatoes. So maybe Greek potatoes along with a nice fresh salmon, that to me would work nicely.
Now, real quick, just on Greek potatoes, we should explain what that is a little bit to people. So it's not just roasting the potatoes. You're just kind of roasting them with a little bit of broth and lemon. And is that it, or is it more to that?
Yeah, that's it. That's, the longest part of the preparation is literally the roasting. That's the largest part of the preparation.
Okay.
So you're going to get some oregano, you're going to get some some olive oil and probably some chicken stock along with the juice of three or four lemons. You cut, it's usually Yukon Gold or fresh new potatoes and that kind of stuff. Put those in the pan. You're going to add your sauce, salt and pepper, throw it in the oven for I think it's about 40 minutes, 40, 45 minutes at about 370, and you're good.
Amazing. Okay, so Greek potatoes, I love that. So that's now the side dish we're adding to this meal, all paired with a Vancouver Island Pinot Noir. And I'm just looking at the time. I got to take our quick break here. And then when we come back, we'll move on to yet another wine. In fact, we got some reds and whites to hit up. But I do want to ask you a bit about what makes Vancouver Island Pinot Noir stand out compared to others. So let's do that in just a moment on Dork Uncorked. Well, we're back at it doing this.
And now, pair this.
Oh, he's sweating. We're making him work. It's like a training montage of wine pairing. That's what we're doing here. Rod is pairing a wine that I give him to several different food items, like a multi-course meal. Because, you know, sometimes it's hard to pair a wine to multiple things. Because it might go really well with the meat you're having, but maybe it doesn't go well with the salad you had or something like that. So that's what we're doing. And before we just move on to the next wine, before the break, we did Vancouver Island Pinot Noir, which you paired with salmon, Greek potatoes on the side, and a goat cheese arugula salad that is just oil and sunflower seeds. No vinegar touching this thing, please, says Rod Phillips.
yeah.
So that's the first meal. Already a great start, I think. But before we move on to the next wine, I just wanted to talk a bit about Vancouver Island Pinot Noir and what makes it, like, what does Vancouver Island do to the Pinot Noir that makes it stand out in a way that you wouldn't be getting from some other part of the world?
Well, they stir it to the left as opposed to the right.
Okay,
and that's
I see.
That's the answer to that. Yeah. of course, every growing region will have its own unique flavor profiles, right? Because the way that the sun, the soil, the water interact is unique to our area, and the temperatures and all that is unique to our area. So you can have the same, what is called a clone, that is grown, say, at Quail's Gate in the Okanagan and in Burgundy in France, and it will taste slightly different in all three areas. And one of the things that I like about what Vancouver Island is, what really makes it special here in Vancouver Island is that you've heard the term heartbreak grape.
Yes,
before.
Because it's so hard to grow that Pinot Noir.
Yeah. So, as much as we all refer to Burgundy as one of the best places in the world for Pinot Noir, it took them 200 years to get it right. Right. So we've really benefited with a lot of the winemakers here on the island, that we've been able to take a lot of that knowledge, a lot of the knowledge about viticultural practices, and a lot of the knowledge about soil and all that kind of stuff, and been able to plant Pinot Noir in the right spots, and therefore generate a wine that has a lot of unique characters to it, but also has some of the things that we want the reasons why we fell in love with Pinot Noir in the first place. Silky finish. Like literally when you look at it in the glass, it may be lighter in color, but man, it packs a punch in terms of flavor, nuances, finesse, cherry, a little bit of cola, maybe some blueberry. There's all sorts of things that come out of it and because of the region, where we are growing it, I think there's just a little bit more oomph to it. Like, you got to be paying, I'll call it, $45-$50 for the kind of quality out of, say, the Okanagan. You're paying $70 for the same kind of quality out of France. You could probably pay $30 and get a top quality Vancouver Island Pinot Noir that has a lot of the same characteristics, just a little bit cheaper.
I love it. And it's sort of neat that Vancouver Island is starting to produce some of these things really well. Because, I mean, maybe 20, 30 years ago, this is not a conversation we would be having. But now I think it really does stand up. And maybe we should just leave it there at Vancouver Island Pinot Noir. But are there any particular ones that if I were to say, hey, go pick me up a Vancouver Island Pinot Noir, where would your mind go to?
Yeah, my mind goes immediately to Alderley.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorites there. Blue Gross would be another one. And then Avril Creek has always, they've had some ups and downs, but lots of people have had ups and downs. And that's where I would go. Those would be the three that I would seek out.
All right. We're off to a great start in this and now pair this round. And I want to move on to my next wine. Another red. We're going to do one more red before we move on to whites and other things. And I'm going to stick with our BC focus. So I'm moving off of Vancouver Island now. I'm heading over to the Okanagan. And a grape that the Okanagan does really nicely is the Cabernet Franc. You've got an Okanagan Cab Franc, Rod, and you got to pair a couple or more things to it. What are you doing?
Yeah, okay. Cabernet Franc. Well, I would probably go with, to start with, like a cream of mushroom soup.
Ooh, I love
something
it. That's
along
cool.
Along those lines. Yeah. You want something with a little bit of like a savory character to it. And what that will do is pick up a little, like one of the things that Cabernet Franc is known for is its aromatics. So that, and hence why in Bordeaux they use Cabernet Franc to blend, is because the aromatics that Cabernet Sauvignon just doesn't have. But here in BC, we can make great Cabernet Franc that has a lot of the characteristics of Bordeaux right in that one grape, but it's the aromatic. So you want something that's got a little bit of an earthiness to it. And along the same lines with the main dish, I would go with, it could be a roasted chicken, a roasted game hen or anything like that. Stay maybe even, first thing that comes to my mind is like venison or something like that, but that might be a little over the top, but yeah, go with a roasted chicken. And again, keep it simple. I wouldn't put a lot of, you know, like one of my favorite dishes of roasted chicken is literally in the cavity is you're putting in some lemon, garlic, and that kind of stuff. And the jus that comes out of that has so much flavor to it. And it enlivens the palate so nicely, but you still get a lot of the savory characters out of the roast chicken. So that's kind of what I would do.
Now you got like a roast chicken, some simple seasoning like lemon, garlic. I'm assuming salt and pepper you can throw in there. But Rod, I can't let you stop there. I got to press because you're not just having roast chicken and nothing else on the plate. What else is going on with that roast chicken? You got to fill
Greek
that plate.
Greek potatoes, for sure.
Yeah, throw some Greek potatoes in there. What about just simple potatoes, like just basic mashed potatoes, roast potatoes? You know, what would you put on there?
Yeah, I would go like again, going along the same line. This is the savory elements. I would go with a garlic mashed. So like a mashed potato and you know, roast some garlic and put that together with some butter and man, you've got a treat right there.
All right. But you know, my little like food groups alarm is going off. All right. I got meat. I've got dairy. I've got.
Oh, you know, so I know where you're going.
Where's the vegetable?
You would like some vegetation. You like some vegetation.
Now, how will you possibly pair a vegetable to Cabernet Franc? This is the toughest I've worked you today.
Yeah, well, you'd have to roast it, so you bring out the sugars in, and therefore you're probably looking at a root vegetable. Parsnip comes to mind. Squash comes to mind. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just genetics. I do not like roasted carrots, but I do know a lot of people who do. But so maybe throw some roasted carrots in there as well. And again, you want to keep this really, really simple. I would take some of the jus that you're getting out of the, or the light gravy you're getting out of the roasted chicken and put that over like that, put it in the same, roast in the same pan. Like that's, you know, those are the kind of flavors that I want to bring to the vegetation.
Okay. So we've got cream of mushroom soup as a starter, followed by a roast chicken, simply seasoned with maybe lemon, garlic, salt, pepper, garlic mashed potatoes, and roast parsnip or roast squash as the veggie side. I think that is now, Rod, I'm satisfied. This is a complete meal. I'm I'm happy with this.
Okay.
That's Okanagan Cabernet Franc. And kind of like the last one, I'm causing us to go above the usual Dork and Cork price range, I assume, with an Okanagan Cabernet Franc. You're probably not finding that for under $20 often, or maybe you are. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, from time to time, you might. I doubt you will from this point on, given you know the challenges the Okanagan is going to have just to supply the market. But most of the quality Cabernet Francs that I immediately think of are in that anywhere late 20s to $30 range. Yeah, that's where they live.
But let's move to whites.
All right. I think, you know, let's go. You must have a couple white wines.
I sure do. Now,
to kick me off with.
After going kind of into some just sort of generic regions on the last one, I want to dial right into a very specific wine that we have often talked about on Dork Uncorked, so I know you're familiar with this. It's the type of wine I like to just keep around the house because I actually find it fairly versatile. It's one that, like, I can reach for if I don't know what else to do, and that is the Casal Garcia Vino Verde. I find it a very food-friendly wine, Rod.
It is very food-friendly. I mean, yeah, it's very food-friendly. And it can start with, you know, some of the lightest, you know, a fruit salad even. You know, if you want to start with, you know, here, boy, I'm already in it. So
okay, you like this one. Good, good.
I'm going to take some of that arugula that we had earlier because we have a little bit extra now, you know, so we didn't eat all the arugula from last time.
Yeah, we bought a big Costco-sized box of it. We only used part of it for that Pinot Noir meal the other day. What are we going to do with the rest of this arugula?
That's right. We got some grape or cherry tomatoes. We're going to cut those in half and add those in. We're going to take a little, you can get some what they call mini bocconcini. And it's if you know what bocconcini is, it's like a mozzarella, like that's done like a light cheese, not a ton of flavor. Get the mini ones, cut those in half, throw those in there. You get you can get what is called like a balsamic glaze. I know earlier on I mentioned vinaigrette, it's not my thing, but this balsamic glaze is called Nono's. And Nono's balsamic glaze is a wonderful dressing for a salad. You don't need a lot of it. It's got a fairly intensive flavor profile, which, you know, balsamic vinegar does. So just, you know, put a little bit of that on the arugula, the tomatoes, and the bocconcini, and now you've got the perfect salad to go with a Casal Garcia Vino Verde.
Now, it's also cool. I was also going to say it's neat that this is a wine that can kind of stand up to the vinegar of a balsamic glaze.
Yeah, yeah. And so what will happen is that the fruit flavors of the wine will pop, like will really come through. And because you've got some acid, you got some fats, and you've got some earthy tones that come from the arugula, and that'll make the Vino Verde pop. Now, for food, you know, the classic would be a local whitefish, so cod. You know, one of the most classic dishes that you'll find in that area of Portugal is a salt cod, essentially. But you just, you know, get a baked cod, grill it maybe. It doesn't have to be fancy. You don't need a lot of, you could do panko, like a panko dressing on the cod. Again, really nice and light. That would be kind of where I would go. Otherwise, if you don't want to go cod, or even if you don't like to go fish, just a simple chicken breast would be where I'd go. Grill that, maybe some simple spices on top of that. Nothing, you know, you don't have to go really crazy on it. Again, maybe you want to dress it up with some panko or something like that.
Okay, this is
now
great.
Now you're going to ask me about starches and vegetables, right?
Give me a darn starch. Well, you know what? You're covered. You got vegetables covered in the arugula and the cherry tomato, so I got to give you a break on that. But, you know, throw a starch at me.
All right. Well, in this case, I would use I would make a little risotto. I'd make a little light risotto, probably like an asparagus risotto. You can make risotto really easily. Just, you know, go to and get some arborio rice. There's recipes on each of the types of rice that you can get. And all you're really doing is you're cutting up some onion, maybe a little bit of garlic, and you're sauteing that until it's clarified. So in other words, it's, you know, it's clear. To get it sauteed, you're going to put some olive oil in there. And then you're adding in the arborio rice while it's still hot. Add in some salt and some pepper, and you'll know when it's ready to add the broth when you can smell the pepper from the heat. That's when you know that you're ready to add the broth. So then you're adding like a chicken broth, or you can use a vegetable broth, and you're going to add that for probably about 20 minutes or so. Every time it seems to reduce out, add some more in. Reduce out, add some more in. After about 25 to 30 minutes, depending on, you know, if the rice is done, now you can add in the asparagus. You can finally chop the asparagus, put that in there, and it adds again a savory element to it. But after, it takes about, like I say, about 40 minutes or so before the risotto is done, and you'll have a sticky rice dish with the asparagus right in there, and it's absolutely delicious.
I love this. So the Casal Garcia Vino Verde. It's from Portugal. It's very easy to find, very affordable, very food friendly. And we've got To start, the arugula, cherry tomato, mini bocconcini cheese salad with a balsamic glaze for the dressing. And then it's going to be followed by a panko breaded cod served with an asparagus risotto on the side. Oh, man. Rod, you're really knocking it out of the park. I want to make all of these things. Like, I got to find time to make every single thing you've mentioned as a meal coming up. But I got one more for you. We're going to run out of time soon, but I got one more here to sneak in.
All right.
Now, this one's kind of fun. I want to do another vino verde, but what about the rosé version? Does that actually change anything? Mm-hmm. And once a little while ago, you mentioned in your pick of the week the Lago. Yeah. I don't know how to pronounce this. Lago?
Yeah, Lago.
Lago Vino Verde Rosé, also from Portugal. It was one of your picks of the week many months ago. So I'm going to use that one. So we had the Castle Garcia White Vino Verde one day. We're going with the Rosé from Lago. What are you doing? Does that change anything? Does that actually cause any difference in what you would pair this with?
It will change the protein.
Okay.
So I wouldn't use cod. I would use salmon. Or snapper or something along those lines. I wouldn't use cod, I would use salmon or snapper. Everything else you can keep the same. Everything else you could do identical.
I actually like that. You know, mm-hmm. it's very much the same recipe, but if you want to go salmon instead of cod, you like salmon better. I don't know, in my household, I'm a big fan of cod. I love cod, I love halibut, I love whitefishes. The rest of my family much prefer salmon, and it's always a bit of a letdown when I show up with whitefish, and they're like, oh. So
you should call me. Okay. I love a good halibut.
Me too,
Man. You know what? Here's something I'll throw that out there. Have you ever been to Varsha?
No, I haven't.
Varsha is on the corner of Pandora and Government Street. It's Indian cuisine.
Yeah, it's very near where I work. I see it all the time.
Yeah, they do a masala fish and chips with halibut.
Yeah.
And so the batter is a masala batter on the halibut. And it is so good. You got to do it. You got
to
do it.
Okay, that's a great tip. I'm going to do that. Also, I'm just saying back to your thing. If I were to go and make that recipe, I might show up with cod and my family would be like, what are you doing? So I'll just change it up for the salmon and just go with the rosé version of the Vino Verde instead. And I got it
there
made.
Go.
Perfect. Look at that.
You're set.
Well, there we go. Set. That was a wonderful round of.
And now, pair this.
Well, we're done, Rod. How do you feel? How do you feel that went? How do you feel you did in the end there?
Well, I'll wait for the feedback from the listener to hear. And if you make any of those dishes, we got to hear from you about that. So,
yeah.
Like, I'm talking to you specifically.
Yeah, well,
so,
I will.
Like, when you make those, yeah, you got to tell us.
Well, I did do that last time. Last time, like I said, that pork tenderloin with the Dijon and the rosemary and the roast. Oh, man. Mm. So I'm looking forward to making some of these and reporting back. And like you said, Rod, if any listeners out there do any of this and have any feedback, we love to hear from you. It's really simple. You can just simply email us at dorkuncorked@gmail.com. Or if you follow Dork Uncorked on any of the social media platforms, you can send us a DM or a comment there, and we'll talk about it on the show. And if you have any ideas for a round of And Now Pair This you would like to see, how would you like to make Rod sweat? Let us know. But
please let us know. Yeah.
And I'll also say that if you've been following along and you thought some of this was great and you'd like to reference what was talked about, I'll put some of the results of this round of And Now Pair This up in the show notes on the podcast, because you can follow Dork and Cork the podcast on your most podcast services, and notes about what Rod paired will be up there once I get the show up. So there you go. But we're almost out of time, and we still have to do the pick of the week, because you're not even done working, Rod. Mm-hmm. We gotta take our last quick break. We'll be back with a very rapid pick of the week in just a moment. And one. All right, you are listening to Dork Uncorked with me, Rod, with him. No, sorry, scratch that, reverse. You're listening to Dork Uncorked with me, Ryan, and he's Rod Phillips, the Dork Uncorked, and we're at the end of the show. See, I'm rushing. I'm like, we've only got a few moments left. I got to get through this. I'm wasting time. Rod, it's the pick of the week where you bring us a wine that outperformed its price, gave great bang for its buck that you tried recently. Where are you going to take us today?
I'm going to take you to Portugal, and I'm going to take you to Provence. So I'm going to actually have two.
What?
Now, one of the, yeah, crazy. quid pro quo is a former pick of the week on the show. It's normally $16, but it's on for $12 right now. Now you can only find it at government stores, but so that's where you go. So it's at $12. It is, you know, absolutely one of the best wine, red wine values on the market. The second thing, because of the seasonal change, and because my wife and eldest daughter are currently in the south of France, in Provence, that I'm going to suggest Domaine Houchart, which is a $20 Provence rosé. If you haven't had Provence rosé, this is what all other rosés in the world are patterning themselves after. The Domaine Houchart has cherry, blueberry, it's crisp, it's clean, goes well with vegetarian cuisine, it goes well with chicken. It is a delightful, delightful. Have it chilled, not cold, have it chilled. Domaine Houchart, rosé from Provence.
Oh, I love that. That's great. So Domaine Houchart, Provence rosé as the main pick of the week, but former pick of the week, quid pro quo from Portugal, happens to be on sale right now, so that's another one to watch for. I love it. Rod, thank you so much. We're right at the time. I look forward to next week.
You bet. Cheers.